This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Police kill striking workers in South Africa.
And Russian rock musicians go to jail. What's that mean for business in Russia? Hello, I'm Jeff Horowitz in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Friday, August the 17th. Coming up, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgage giants, have a new financial relationship with the Treasury Department, and it could be good for both sides.
And we'll dive deep, an investigative report, you might say, into how khakis and a button-down shirt became the unofficial uniform of casual Fridays. That and a bunch more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Well, first to South Africa, where 34 workers have been killed by police at a platinum mine. 78 were wounded. The workers were striking, and some were armed when police charged in. For the latest, here's reporter Gretchen Wilson in Johannesburg.
Police say they had tried to disperse the crowd of 3,000 rock drill operators and other miners who had gathered on a hill near a mine shaft. Many were armed. Most had been there since last Friday. That's when workers walked out of their jobs demanding higher wages. 10 people, including 2 police officers, were killed in the days leading up to yesterday's shooting. The National Union of Mine Workers represents some of the workers at Lonmin. It did not endorse the strike action, which was led by a rival union. Spokesman Lesiba Sashoka calls yesterday's shooting a turning point for the country.
The last time we had so much confrontations was during the dark years of apartheid.
He said the country needs an industry-wide discussion with the mining companies, government, and most importantly with miners themselves. One of the problems is that workers see little benefit from the profits generated by the mining companies. Many still live in dismal conditions.
At every corner of South Africa, communities are rising up. They're saying, look, here is a beautiful mine here. There's no development. The only development we have is a road that leads to the mine.
Police say the shooting is now under investigation. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
That shooting of platinum miners in South Africa is a reminder that our precious metals come from some pretty unstable places. Global platinum prices have been on the rise today. Peter Major is a mining consultant with KD's Corporate Solutions. He's in Cape Town, South Africa. Hello.
Hey, good to talk to you guys.
Platinum prices are rising on global markets today. That would be expected. Is this something consumers or other industries in the West, say, are going to feel?
Well, they'll feel it if it stays here or if it keeps on going up. But I think most of the West has gotten used to falling platinum prices. And overall, platinum's gone flat in dollar terms for about the last 5 years. So this little $50 rise we've had in the last day, they're not even going to notice that.
These riots resulted from labor unrest. And as you said, the price of platinum has been down lately. Is the global market for platinum putting some kind of pressure that's maybe causing problems back at the mines?
Yes, you're exactly right. It's global. It's global offtake, and platinum is a very reusable commodity. So auto catalysts are being recycled. Jewelry is a very large component, maybe 35%.
Mm-hmm.
But people stop buying platinum jewelry when it gets up to $1,800, $2,000 an ounce. And palladium has made big dents into the platinum jewelry market. And basically, the growth in platinum offtake hasn't kept up with the supply.
That makes me wonder if this is a one-off event or if we can expect more trouble, maybe more violence ahead.
Look, on the violent side, we hate to say there's more due, but there's an underlying current going here because The platinum miners are used to double-digit wage increases for the last 10 years, and the mines could pay that because they were getting 15-20% increases in the platinum price for the last 10 years. But now, the last few years, with the platinum price going flat, the mines cannot continue paying 10, 11, 12, 13% wage increases. So that's not going to sit well with the rest of the labor force.
Mining consultant Peter Major, great to talk with you. Thanks.
Very welcome.
Checking U.S. markets, Jeremy, there is not much going on today. It's casual Friday everywhere, I think. flat across the major indices. Asian stock markets closed up. Japan's Nikkei and Hong Kong's Hang Seng both up about 0.8%. European markets also moved higher today after German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she stands behind the European Central Bank. The head of the ECB raised hopes a few weeks ago by promising to do whatever it takes to preserve the euro. Truth is, of course, ECB action is heavily dependent on that German support.
Well, here in this country, there's word this morning that the Treasury Department is going to revamp its financial relationship with the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Ever since being bailed out by the government 4 years ago, Fannie and Freddie have been making quarterly 10% dividend payments to Uncle Sam, even if they have to borrow money to do so. The new plan would require the firms to turn over all of their profits to the government, but they'd pay nothing when they're unprofitable. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial. He joins us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how important is this on the road to recovery for Fannie and Freddie?
I think it's critical, and I think it's important to remember, too, taxpayers are the biggest stockholder in Fannie and Freddie. So it was always sort of stockholders borrowing to pay stockholders, if you will. But the key here is that Fannie and Freddie have operating profits now. Fannie this year, Freddie actually reached that point last year. And loan performance at the companies is starting to improve as well. I think what this does most importantly is it's going to make it easier for Treasury to sell that taxpayer share and get a better deal for us.
And presumably it's also a little easier for Fannie and Freddie since they don't have to make these payments when they're not profitable. So I wonder if it means anything for the housing market in general.
Yeah, it does. You know, I think everybody in Washington and elsewhere is looking forward to a new system of housing. Part of that's going to be reform of Fannie and Freddie. But in the meantime, they're providing an integral role. About 90% of mortgages today are Fannie and Freddie loans. Profitable companies is going to make it that much easier to get that housing business going.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's been an outbreak of West Nile virus in Texas. Dallas County has seen nearly 200 cases of the mosquito-borne illness and 10 deaths. That's led the Dallas mayor to authorize the first aerial spraying of pesticides in that city since the 60s. As its name suggests, West Nile virus originated in Africa. Christopher Worth takes a look at the global economic impact of mosquitoes and the diseases they carry.
No sense yet on what the outbreak in Dallas will cost. An outbreak in Louisiana in 2004 left that state with a tab of over $20 million. But West Nile is just one of many mosquito-borne illnesses. Others include dengue fever and malaria, and the cost there can be much higher. Prue Smith is with the organization Rollback Malaria.
Malaria costs Africa, for example, at least $12 billion every year in lost productivity, in the costs of treating people and deaths, etc. That has a big impact on the economy.
Ann Mills of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine says controlling mosquito-borne diseases can raise a country's GDP. And like the case in Dallas, she says outbreaks have to be tackled fast.
Viruses have the ability to spread very rapidly, and sometimes aerial spraying is indeed the best way of coping with that.
Although she says on environmental grounds, that might not be very popular. I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
A new report out from Bloomberg this morning shows that hiring in the London financial services industry is down, while at the same time it's picking up in New York.
To find out a little bit more about how these two things are related, we have Selena Rogers. She's editorial director at CFO Research for today's Midday Extra. Hi, Selena.
Hi.
So financial hiring up in New York, down in London. Very interesting. How related are these two trends?
Well, I think to some extent they're related, but they're related in the sense that banks are doing what they always do and perhaps what they should do, which is follow the money. In New York, where consumer lending is relatively strong, I think that the data shows that banks are beefing up their presence in consumer lending. And in London, which historically has been more dependent on trading and investment banking, both of those are coming under regulatory pressure. So we see banks retreating somewhat in those markets.
So if it's about consumer lending, then does that mean that other capitals of finance in the United States are also seeing an uptick in hiring?
Well, actually, we don't track that data ourselves, but I think it's quite likely that where there is a stronger market, and certainly in the U.S. with mortgage lending profits going up and consumer credit going up, that it's quite likely that banks across the country, including regional banks, are beefing up their presence in those markets. At the same time, I think it's important to note that those sorts of activities are less profitable than investment banking and trading activities.
So this is really about consumer lending and not maybe the European debt crisis hurting London or something like that.
Well, I think that it's certainly true that the European debt crisis is cutting into banking business across Europe. That cannot be denied. At the same time, I think that this reflects, this data that we're seeing reflects a larger trend in which banks are coming under pressure for the kinds of risky activities that they engaged in during the credit bubble. And that pressure, of course, is coming from large-scale regulatory action that's being taken against them.
Selena, if you follow the recent headlines, money laundering at Standard Chartered and HSBC, the LIBOR manipulation scandal, which was very bad for Barclays Bank, another London institution, could that have anything to do with the emphasis shifting to New York, perhaps?
I'm not sure that it has a direct effect on the shift in banking resources to New York from London. And I think it might not be, strictly speaking, accurate to think about banks engaging in a sort of conscious effort to move resources from London to New York. Mm-hmm. I think that in New York, banks are benefiting from strong consumer lending market, relatively speaking, of course, and from strong mortgage lending, again, relatively speaking. And that's not the case so much in London. So certainly banks have an opportunity to hire in New York, perhaps this year, that they don't have in London. At the same time, I think that the sort of shift in emphasis to more core consumer and commercial lending and away from investment banking and trading activity has to do with larger regulatory trends. That sort of activity, investment banking and proprietary trading, comes with a very high capital cost to banks, particularly under these new regulatory regimes they're subject to. In Europe, that regulatory scrutiny has been quite extreme. Especially in contrast to the relatively hands-off regulatory posture that, for example, UK regulators took during the sort of lead-up to this recent credit crisis.
So do we have any sense of how these two financial capitals are stacking up against each other right now in general?
Well, I think that it's fair to say that both of them are world financial capitals. It seems that at the moment, New York is gaining a bit of an edge over London, which is understandable considering the kind of pressure that the European banking system has fallen under. As you point out, from the sovereign debt crisis, the LIBOR scandal is certainly not helping. But at the same time, I think that London will remain one of the world's financial capitals. And as we've seen in the banking business, this sort of trend can reverse itself over time.
Selena Rogers, editorial director at CFO Research. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
President Obama has launched a new campaign ad defending his record on Medicare. He's come under attack, of course, from the Romney campaign for taking hundreds of billions of dollars out of Medicare to pay for the Affordable Care Act. At the same time, President Obama has attacked Romney's running mate, Paul Ryan, for his plans to cut Medicare. But here is where it gets interesting. Bloomberg News analyzed the two budget plans and found that 10 years out, they actually look pretty similar. Christopher Payne is a senior economic analyst at Bloomberg Government, and he is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how can it be that the budget plans of Paul Ryan and President Obama would end up really in the same place in about 10 years?
Well, Ryan has talked a lot about his long-term vision for a smaller federal government. And I think we all know that in Medicare, he wants to introduce a voucher system which will lower expenses over the long, long term.
Right.
But that's not happening until 2022. And in fact, in the main areas of the budget, defence, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, it's only Medicaid where there is a really discernible difference over the next 10 years. And that's because of the Affordable Care Act that brings a lot of people into Medicaid. In the other areas, they're basically the same. And in defence, they're both looking at shrinking spending as a percent of GDP quite significantly from about 4.5% in 2011 to around about 3% in 2022.
Well, what about when you drill down into the specifics? They can't be that similar.
Well, what I saw was not a lot of explanation for how we're actually going to get to this end result. And I want to talk specifically about this area of the budget called non-defense discretionary, and that's infrastructure and transportation and education grants, where both sides are saying we're going to reduce spending from 4% or so in 2011 down to around about 2% of GDP in 2022. And now these areas of spending have always gone up in line with GDP growth over the last 40 years. So there's not a lot of explanation as how this is going to happen. And it's really a major area of how both plans see bringing down spending.
Christopher Payne, senior economic analyst at Bloomberg Government, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Moscow this morning, a judge convicted and sentenced the three members of a rock band called Pussy Riot to 2 years in prison. In March, they staged an unauthorized performance in Moscow's main cathedral, calling for the Virgin Mary to protect the country against President Vladimir Putin. Their official crime is hooliganism by religious hatred. But to many inside and outside Russia, the case has come to represent considerably more than that. And the verdict comes at a tricky time for Russia on the international stage. Reporter Peter Van Dyke has been watching the verdict for us in Moscow. Hi, Peter.
Hello there, Jeff.
Amid all this, Russia is set to formally join the World Trade Organization next week. One thing that they're supposed to do as a condition of membership is to reform their court system. How does this case look in that regard?
Well, it certainly highlights the need to reform the court system, which is constantly under question here. And the hope is that the accession to the WTO will provide fresh impetus for those reforms to take place, because investors and people who do business here do worry that the commitment of the government to make many, many reforms, including of the court system, is not complete and needs a bit of a push from external factors.
This case is getting such enormous attention internationally. Even though these are rock musicians, is there some effect potentially on the business climate in Russia?
So people who are already invested in Russia won't be that affected by the trial, because they know that this is what goes on in Russia on occasion. But people who aren't here yet and maybe are thinking about coming here, maybe see the WTO membership and think, yes, there's progress happening, then they see this and it makes them take a step back again. So those are the people that often these sorts of things affect.
We may be witnessing one of the more colorful examples of the inefficiencies in Russia's legal system this morning. This court opinion takes hours to read. Is that typical?
It is quite typical. The judge typically starts with a suggestion of the verdict and then goes through much of the testimony that was heard over the court case. In this case, say 3 hours reading testimony that took about a week to hear. In the famous case of the former UKOS head Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the verdict took something like 3 or 4 days. And
wow.
That was back in December 2010. And he is still in jail, and again, a factor in why people worry about doing business in Russia.
Reporter Peter Van Dyke in Moscow. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, it is Friday, Jeff, of course, which means for some people it is casual Friday.
I think it's always casual Friday around here.
Yeah, that's
casual
right.
Monday,
that's right.
Tuesday. But yeah,
Los Angeles, casual every day. In New York, it's a little more formal, I guess, in this office than our LA office. But still, you know, people wearing jeans in a lot of cases and not too formal. But, you know, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has been looking into the strange story of how exactly a button-down shirt and khakis became the unofficial casual Friday uniform. And here she is with her report.
Our story starts in 1966, when the Hawaiian garment industry was trying to sell more shirts. Their answer?
It's Aloha Friday. No work till Monday.
Mufi Hanuman, the former mayor of Honolulu, was a kid when Aloha Fridays first launched. He says what began as a gimmick to wear Hawaiian shirts to the office once a week became a cultural statement.
Don't take yourself too seriously and don't get caught up in the rat race. Relax.
Cut to the recession of the early 1990s, Aloha Fridays had drifted to the mainland in the form of casual Fridays, and they'd become a perfect no-cost perk for strapped companies trying to make their employees feel more relaxed. Just not too relaxed.
We found when guys shed their coats and ties.
Rick Miller was doing PR for the Levi's brand Dockers back then.
People were showing up in the Hawaiian print shirt or sandals and shorts. Frankly, there were concerns on the part of management that work might become too much fun.
What management saw as a concern, Levi's saw as a way to save itself. Jean sales were slowing now that baby boomers were getting older. So in 1992, Miller's team had an idea. They printed up a guide to casual business wear and sent it to 25,000 human resource managers across the country.
That showed different business casual looks.
And surprise, a lot of them involved Dockers.
Like how to match a button down with a pair of Dockers and a nice pair of loafers.
Dockers sponsored in-office fashion shows and a hotline for dress code emergencies. Soon, they were everywhere.
Dockers was considered revolutionary.
Terry Agins writes in her book, The End of Fashion, about visiting an executive at Alcoa and being shocked by his outfit.
Slacks, cashmere V-neck sweater. Looked like he was there like on a Saturday, but actually this was a regular work day.
Of course, 20 years later, Dockers doesn't seem quite as revolutionary. Jennifer Say is a VP for global marketing at Dockers.
We're aware. We've become the uniform of the cubicle dweller, the guy who doesn't care.
But she says they're fighting that stigma with something called the alpha khaki. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Well, you can see a copy of that old guide to casual business wear at marketplace.org. And while you're on our website, you should let us know what your casual Fridays look like at work.
Two communities in California are contemplating a new tactic in the fight against obesity, Jeremy, Richmond and El Monte. They're looking at a new tax on stores and restaurants based on how many ounces of sugary drinks they sell. These businesses, most people expect, will pass that cost along to consumers, and it will affect their diet choices. Call this the battle of the big gulp. Here's KQED's Mina Kim.
If voters approve Richmond's penny-per-ounce tax this fall, expect that 20-ounce soda that costs, say, a dollar, to go up to $1.20. Would that stop you from buying it? I posed that question to Raymond Landry, who had just bought an Arizona iced tea from a Richmond convenience store. He said no.
I'm going to drink sugar-sweet beverages. My children are going to drink sugar-sweet beverages.
But Lisa Powell, a senior researcher in health policy at the University of Illinois, says there is a link between higher taxes and less consumption.
Generally, approximately a 10% increase in price would reduce consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages by about 12%.
Now, whether or not that translates into curbing obesity, Powell says, depends on what people substitute for that soda. If it's water, they'll probably lose weight. A chocolate donut, not so much. In San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim for Marketplace.
And Jeremy, another attack on soft drinks is underway in Canada, as a matter of fact. A band of thieves has been making their way from Nova Scotia in the east to Quebec to Ontario and all the way across Calgary and Edmonton. And the way they've been able to track that it's the same group of people is that they've been funding their little joyride by robbing the exact same model of Pepsi machine. And they have hit dozens of these by this point. Apparently, they've just perfected their technique on this one machine. And, you know, if it ain't broke, don't, you know, why fix it? Stick with what works.
Yeah.
One machine, this is kind of amazing, can yield up $1,000, maybe more,
wow,
in quarters. And these guys are still on the loose, but they might not be hard to spot. They'll be the ones paying in coins.
Walking around with a big bag full of quarters.
I don't know.
Well, you know, the state of California, Jeff, is asking residents to rat out their neighbors. That's the new thing in California.
Oh, that's fun.
The Highway Patrol says that drivers that come in from out of state are not registering their cars in the state, thereby cheating the state out of millions of dollars.
Taxes, yeah.
So they say if you see someone doing that, you should report them. And I would just caution, if you do that, just don't expect to get any salt, pepper, or maybe a lawnmower the next time you need one.
Good neighborly love here in California, encouraged by the state. That's nice. In Los Angeles, where I am actually driving a car with out-of-state plates,
uh-oh,
but I might be here,
uh-oh,
just temporarily.
I'm going to report you.
I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.